You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I feel extraordinarily honoured and privileged to be in the position to form a government with Labour at the lead.
New Zealand has a new Prime Minister, adding to the global cohort of national leaders making a rapid ascent at a young age. My guests Linda Yu and Tim Marshall will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Spain's debatably constructive efforts to dissuade Catalonia from leaving it, what one does to rebuild a city which has been destroyed in order to save it, and we'll ask how much room for free expression and error there is for a pilot landing an Airbus A330.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Linda Yu, the economist and broadcaster, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com, former diplomatic editor of Sky News. Welcome both. Now, days after Austria elected the world's youngest head of a democratic government in the form of 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz, New Zealand has, if I've done the maths right, found itself with the third youngest after Kurz and one of San Marino's two current captains regent. Labour Party leader Jacinda Ardern, 37, has become New Zealand's third female prime minister after a few weeks of wrangling and horse trading following the country's election last month. She is not, fascinatingly, New Zealand's youngest ever national leader, being a few weeks older than Sir Edward Stafford was when first elected Premier in 1856. Linda, first of all, there will be attempts, and there's one coming up right now, to bracket her alongside the likes of Macron, Trump, to a slightly lesser extent, Justin Trudeau. Are we seeing a global electoral fondness for novelty? I mean, you could even stir Trump and Brexit into that, if you liked.
Maybe we'll steer away from that at the start of the programme. But yes, I think there is an attempt to basically place her in the same category as Justin Trudeau, as Emmanuel Macron. Those comparisons have already been made, that she's energising the party. She's changed the electorate. Election and her youth becomes an asset. Although, Andrew, I'm beginning to notice the leaders are actually just getting younger and younger. We are going from...
That's because we're getting older.
No, I think that's exactly what happens. I mean, I am myself, for reasons listeners can guess at, in favour of raising the voting age to 47, never mind the cut-off point for standing for electoral office. Tim, energising, yes. as Linda says, is the least of it. She overcame a 19-point poll deficit in a month.
Yeah.
How?
She. I mean, look, I'll be honest with you, I'm not particularly familiar with her, but you know, I've done the reading, I've looked into it, and I sort of vaguely follow New Zealand politics the way most people do. She has got a real dynamism. She is a sensible sort of centre-left, third-way internationalist. The other lot weren't looking too good. She's absolutely a breath of fresh air compared to her predecessor as leader of the Labour Party. But when I started reading about her, she seems to be a real person, and this goes to what Linda says. Younger, more dynamic, more connected with everybody else than a generation. Just a few things. Her favourite schoolwork? Metalwork. She drinks whiskey.
Coffee, though.
I'll come to that. She drinks whiskey. She has a cat called Paddles. It's called Paddles because it's got extra toes.
There's so many jokes about New Zealand I'm going to rise above making right there.
Yeah, she doesn't drink coffee because she used to be a Mormon. She became agnostic because she couldn't countenance her faith with the Mormon church's view on homosexuality, which again makes her a modern person. So I just think all that has come together at the right moment for her, and she seems to be someone who speaks human as opposed to these identikit politicians that come out of the mould in most of the Western countries now.
Linda, on that subject of speaking human, quite early on after she became Labour leader, which was a position that sort of descended upon her more or less out of the blue, she was asked a series of impertinent would be a polite way of putting it, idiotic would be a more accurate one, questions about her plans for motherhood and so on. Did her fairly brisk reaction to that play a part in her victory?
I think her frankness and the fact that she does sound like a modern person speaking about it probably helps. So I think on a couple of occasions she was asked and she said, I'm running for office. I've put it on the table. Feel free to ask me about motherhood. But in another interview, when a guest had suggested to, that employers had a right to ask women because if they're going to have children, that will affect their employment continuity and what have you. And she said, well, it's fair for me, but it's not fair for those women that their jobs would depend on their motherhood choices. Mm. So I think it goes to this idea that I think that she is... doesn't come across like a politician, although we have to stress she is a politician. She worked for Helen Clark, who was the first female prime minister of New Zealand for a long time. And I think I get the sense that jumping into the fray wasn't necessarily her first thought. It took her a while to decide to become to take on the mantle, as it were, of becoming leader of the Labour Party and then eventually, well, now becoming prime minister. So in that sense, that's also very human, because I think a lot of us find it rather suspicious that some people just want to be president and prime minister. And there's something about the reluctance about with which she went about it, I think, I would imagine, well, clearly has appealed to voters.
I'm glad you brought those questions that she was asked, because that's when she first came to the world's attention.
Certainly really. A lot of international attention,
around about
yes.
The summer, was it? Or
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Earlier this year.
Time, in the current political climate, yeah. Tim, time has ceased to have any meaning.
And, yes, 6 months is a long time in politics. I warmed to her because she responded to those two questions that Linda's just laid out, not in a hard, brittle, antagonistic way, which she could have done, because you can make the argument, as you did, that those questions are too old-fashioned to even ask now. I thought they were framed in a way which... could just about make them acceptable. But she responded not with cold anger. She responded, look, you know, here's me, here's how I feel about it, I'm setting my stall out. And she wouldn't have put very many people off by that. And that's a rare quality in a politician, to be able to speak as herself, but without sounding arrogant or hard or cold. Or, I mean, look, you're not a crazy feminist if you do take a hard line, but it's not always the best way to persuade people that don't always agree with you when you take a brittle, hard, cold line. And she's clearly pretty smart and seems quite a warm person.
Linda, as you were saying, she seems to be, or will be, I think, in the popular imagination, allied with a kind of new wave of centrist-ish, youngish leaders like your Macrons and Trudeaus and Kurtzes. She's going to need to be good at that. She is going to lead a minority government with both the Green Party, who seem like reasonably natural allies of the Labour Party, and New Zealand First, who rather don't. They are a somewhat nationalist, somewhat bellicose populist outfit led by Winston Peters, who seems to be enjoying his role as kingmaker possibly that little bit too much.
And I think this also mirrors a trend we've seen in other places where more far-right-ish parties play a role in government. Now, of course, we saw this in Austria as well. I think in New Zealand's case, given... you know, they have issues around immigration. There's a number of things, I think, that also fit that pattern. But yes, I think she's going to find ruling might be slightly more difficult, considering the opposition actually has more seats in the New Zealand Parliament.
Indeed they do. It is going to be a tricky one, but let us leave it there for the moment and look now at the shortly to be less autonomous Spanish province of Catalonia. Spain's government has said that it will meet this weekend to begin the process of activating Article 155 of the country's constitution, which will allow it to take over the running of Catalonia. By way of response, Catalonia President Carles Puigdemont threatened to ask Catalonia's parliament to vote on the declaration of independence he has himself refrained from issuing since Catalonia voted in a dubious referendum to secede on October 1st. Tim, you are very recently back from Madrid.
Last night, yeah.
Just last night, in fact. My question is, if Spain actually wanted Catalonia to declare independence, what would it be doing differently?
See, lying behind your question is that they've done everything, I assume, you think they've done everything wrong, bullheaded and pushing them away.
Basically, yes.
I think there's something in what you said. The sending in the police to crack heads with truncheons was clearly completely out of order. Taking the hard legalistic line of the rule of law, not necessarily. Now, bear with me. The Catalonians have a problem. They are a nation within a nation, one of the nations within a nation state, Spain. The way the constitution is written is that you have to have a two-thirds of the country represented in parliament to agree you can have a referendum in order to leave. So it's built into the system that you're never going to get that majority. So although the constitution seems to allow you to leave, it actually doesn't. So I've got a lot of sympathy for the Catalonians in that respect. Moving on, they do then hold this referendum, even though they've been told by the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be separate from the government, that it is illegal. Only half of the Catalonians vote, because the ones who want to remain with Spain boycotted it. So I'm really not convinced it has that much validity. This is not about whether I want Catalonian independence or not. It's about the rule of law. Hasn't got that much validity. If you take that view, Spain has the right to take a pretty hard line that this is illegal. These are illegal acts, and we have to act, because if we don't, the whole thing falls apart. The biggest mistake they made was cracking their heads with the police. Why shouldn't they be now defending the rights of the 50% of Catalonians who do not want to leave Spain? Why shouldn't they be defending that?
They do. I mean, that has been their point, obviously, that in point of law, Madrid's position is fairly solid. I don't think anybody seriously disputes that under Spanish law, the referendum was illegal and carries no legal weight. But as Spain is learning, the law is often not quite enough. Is the legalistic approach actually going to resolve this to Madrid's satisfaction, Linda?
I don't necessarily think it will, and this is the reason. I think Catalonia, the Catalan crisis, is erupting now because of the very, very heavy-handed way that the Rajoy government treated those who wanted this referendum. But it's been an issue that's been brewing for some time. So clearly, the constitutional legal arrangements have been in place since, the 70s, since the end of the Franco dictatorship, are not adequate. You have people who want to have independent self-rule, and the degree of decentralization in Spain, I think it is the most decentralized nation in Europe, is still not giving them, they feel, enough of a say in how they wish to be governed as a people. And that sentiment runs much deeper than anything, I think, legal law or norms could place upon it. So I guess the other element of this is that I think Rajoy is aware of it. He's actually quite a centrist politician, despite the very bad call that we just discussed a moment ago. So he's giving them an unlimited amount of time to respond to say whether they really wish to leave. So in many ways, I view this as one of the examples that you often find of geopolitical situations that can't be resolved. They just get brushed under the carpet. You just kind of hope some resolution happens. But underneath, there's still quite a lot of issues. You think about Ireland and Northern Ireland until the Good Friday Agreement. You think about Taiwan and China. You think about, there's quite a few of these instances where preserving the status quo is tenuous, and yet that seems to be the most plausible outcome.
Tim, is Madrid betting on the idea that at some point the economic reality of independence is going to overcome national sentiment? Because one of the things we have seen in the last week was the EU making it clear in no uncertain terms that Catalonia would be out and it wouldn't be coming back in. We saw several important Catalonian employers saying we are off and taking our jobs and our tax base with us. But as we have seen all over the world in recent years, especially expecting people to vote according to their own narrow economic self-interest, you can end up being quite dramatically wrong.
Yes, that's the mistake intellectuals and liberal intellectuals particularly make. They think that because they think logically, everyone else has to agree with the way that they think, and that consequently, you'd be a fool to leave the EU, or you'd be a fool to leave Britain if you're Scottish, or you'd be a fool to leave Spain if you're Catalonian. And the people who want to leave are not thinking to themselves, I'm a fool. They're thinking, yeah, I know the economic arguments mean I might be worse off, but you know what? And this is an emotional argument, but my emotions think I am a nationalist. I want the Catalonian nation to determine its own future. And that trumps your economic logic. And there's not enough people who seem to understand that's the case. And when we talk about this also, the problem is that the media, for the first two or three days, the media framed this in freedom-loving Catalonians. It took them two or three days to work out, oh, actually, probably not even a majority. Well,
the international media in particular, I do wonder the extent to which Barcelona and Catalonia are, for want of a less crass term, cool, had an effect on this. Whether if this had been a kind of rugged industrial area of Germany, whether there would have been quite the same sympathy.
Or whether it had been a horrible, nasty right-wing type of nationalists, the wrong sort of nationalists, for example. Now, that always plays a role. The media always does this. It goes in straight away. Within the first two or three days of any crisis, there is a veering towards one side of a narrative. And it's very difficult to course correct that and start looking, oh, well, actually, there is another side. And again, I'm not making a case for or against either side. I cannot resist this, though, Andrew. And because you know me, you'll know why. I was over in Madrid and people very kindly booked me into a hotel, and it was called the Hotel Catalonia. Which allowed me, you know where I'm going with this, don't you?
I'm adopting the brace position.
Yeah, which allowed me to, when I met up with my friends, to say, yeah, thanks for booking that hotel. But the funny thing was, when I went to pay this morning, they said, you can check out, but you can never leave.
Did it make you wish that you were still a diplomatic correspondent so you could have finished your piece to camera with that one? Linda, is the economic argument, and you are an economist, always going to be at a disadvantage when it runs up against the sort of the sentimental nationalist one?
I think
it's not sentimental. There's a value judgment there, Andrew.
Nationalism is by definition sentimental, Tim.
I think
it's a sentiment.
I think every time we've had the Scottish referendum, we've had the EU referendum here in this country, and every time I end up commenting on it and analyzing it, I often always end up saying, is your vote despite the economic costs? Because the reality for most of these referendum is that in Catalonia is the richest state in Spain. It has, it generates a fifth of its tax revenues. However, it is still small. So if it leaves Spain and it leaves the European Union, and it's not even clear whether it'll be able to use the euro if it were to leave, economically, it may recover in a long time from now. But in the foreseeable future, you're accepting economic cost for the desire, the political desire to be independent. And I think that's pretty common across all of these. I'm not suggesting in two generations' time or what have you, that the situation may not look different. It probably will. But at this point, I think people who are voting, they're accepting an economic damage or economic cost as the price they're willing to pay for independence, for being able to call themselves Catalans or,
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Linda Yu and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, what now for what's left of Raqqa?
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Linda Yu and Tim Marshall. And let's look now at Raqqa, which, as of its recapture by the US-backed Syrian Democratic Forces this week, is no longer the de facto capital of the Islamic State. That's the good news. The bad news is that a massive and expensive rebuilding job now faces what was once Syria's sixth largest city and is now a ruin. The US State Department has said that the US will take the lead in restoring essential services to what remains of Raqqa. Tim, basic question to which I cannot yet fix in my head a satisfactory answer. Who actually owns Raqqa now?
If you're talking about power coming from the barrel of a gun, the Kurds. Because the Kurdish-led forces have taken it from
This is the
ISIS.
SDF.
Yes. They are dominated by the Kurds, armed by the Americans. They are the most efficient fighting force. But they know they can't stay there. This is an Arabic town, not a Kurdish-speaking town. They will go. I don't think they particularly want Raqqa, so they will leave. The problem is, and let me just briefly put in Kirkuk to the argument across in Iraq. That is a contested town which the Iraqi army and the Shia militia have just taken from the Kurds because the Kurds pretty much realized we can't hold it, and they have retreated back to the defined lines of Kurdistan. And it's not contested. They've pretty much accepted we can't have Kirkuk, the Kurds. Raqqa will be contested by different tribes, by the army, by the Assad forces, by the opposition forces. The Kurds will want some of the territory just above it. So the fighting in Raqqa is not necessarily finished. It's just that ISIL has been defeated and pushed out. So the reconstruction may have to commence with still the political decisions to be made about who is going to control Raqqa. Like I said, the Syrian government in Damascus says that's part of Syria, we want it. The opposition forces say no way, the different tribal groups, and you've still got some of the jihadist groups that will say they want to control it. So I don't think it has to erupt in a seven-way war, but that is the danger if you don't get the politics right, and all the time you're going to have to try and rebuild this city.
Linda, is it imaginable, thinking, you know, with your economist's hat on, that anybody's going to be too excited in the prospect of investing in Raqqa's rebuilding while nobody has a clue who actually owns it now or who's likely to 6 months or 5 years from now?
I wouldn't count on private investment rebuilding the city. I think U.S. Government money, which is currently restoring water, basic services, I think that's probably where we're going to have to look to. And to make the city, I think, at least habitable again and improve the standards of living for some of its inhabitants. But as we know, money which comes from the U.S. or foreign power, unless there is once you get past the immediate humanitarian crisis, which by the way, in terms of Raqqa, I don't think that'll be anytime soon, that funding tends to fall off. And then that's when you open up the space for other forces to begin to contest. So once the Americans leave, after providing basic services, then who's in control? And I think that's why it's very difficult unless the political situation is completely, well, sorted to a high degree before you would expect private investors, funders, businesses to go in to provide anything other than, you know, going in to make a quick buck. You can imagine, I know people who sell beer who go into post-war places because they can make a quick buck and leave. But that's not exact. Beer is not necessarily what you want if you want to rebuild a city. Now, Andrew and Tim, you two may disagree with me, but I'm going to maintain that, you know.
I mean, you're entitled to a cold one once you've finished rebuilding the city. But possibly, I mean, Tim.
Sorry for your ISIS.
Tim, there are obviously all sorts of reasons why it's difficult to imagine it happening. But is there a case for a UN force,
yes,
at least in the vicinity of Raqqa?
Well, no, I don't know about a UN force, but I think UN teams, which then
but
may need
the
protecting.
UN teams would need a...
Yeah, this is where it gets difficult. I think the UN money would be the best, and coming in and getting the basics of the electricity and the water, and the Americans are funding that. Now, you can get down from Turkey all the way down the corridor to Raqqa in relative safety if you're the right flavor, and American convoys would be okay, you know, international convoys. Turkey and the Kurdish forces and the allies would allow the corridor for at least the basics to be done, but that's not a long-term solution. And then we come back round to Linda's idea that, well, private enterprise is not going to go into that massively high-risk situation. So they really are in a difficult situation. In the short term, I think there'll be relative calm, water and electricity, people will start to trickle back. And if you can get the politics right, there is the corridor leading up to Turkey. You can get aid in. It doesn't have to fall apart again, but they're going to have to get the politics right. And that requires the big macro picture of solving Syria, which then immediately means you have to solve Iran and Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So, you know, it's not going to happen
this year.
And unfortunately, we can't do it right now as we've only got the 4 minutes left. But finally tonight, we should move on. Most of us have, at some point, I think, fantasized about checking out of some or other aspect of employment with something of a flourish, and most of us have thought better of it before we did it, probably wisely. Spare a thought, then, for the pilots of an Air Berlin A330 who commemorated the soon-to-be-permanently-grounded airline's last long-haul flight to its Dusseldorf hub by pulling a go-around over the airport. The pilots have now been suspended by the airline. Linda, they didn't loop the loop or try and barrel roll the thing or anything. Is this an overreaction by Air Berlin?
It's probably one of those things where it's better safe. You know, it's better to be safe. And just to tell pilots, no flybys, no go around with a sharp veer upwards to, you know, it's just not what you should do when you have a plane full of passengers. But I guess, you know, I guess this pilot, he wanted to say a goodbye in a pilot sort of way.
I mean, I would possibly, I suspect, have less of a sense of humour about this if I'd been on the plane. I've been on two go-arounds that I can recall, one of which was relatively painless. The other one, pulling up from, at the absolute last minute, wheels already down at Elko Airport in Nevada in a twin-prop plane in the middle of a blizzard, and then flying around in the snow for 40 minutes trying to find the airport. Not an experience I would care to repeat. Tim, did the pilots overcook this one?
I really don't want to agree with Linda. Not because of the, not because I think she's wrong. It's just because my sense of fun wants the pilot to be leaning out of the window with a middle finger to wherever the headquarters is and a banner flying behind it saying "Screw you." That's what I actually want to happen.
But there was that sensation a couple of years ago, wasn't there, when an air steward in America grabbed the beers out of the drinks trolley and then hit the slide while the plane was obviously parked and became something of a folk.
Well, that's admirable. Because it was on the ground, but I'm afraid.
Well, in air, obviously, that would be.
The problem is that Linda is right. If you're talking about a plane and other people, I'm afraid you have to put your emotions second to that. I've had three. One was the corkscrew into Baghdad during the really tough years when the big pilots in the passenger jets had to pretty much do a nosedive to get in because you were in range if you actually circled around. That was horrible. Frankfurt Airport, snowstorm, came down, wheels touched, then we went back up because there was another plane that came across us. No, you don't mess around with plane safety. I thought we were doing celebrations.
Well, we were going to talk about premature or mistimed celebrations, which I'm a big fan of in the sporting context. But I did want to ask you both. I'll ask you first, Linda. Have you ever signed off out of a job with a possibly misjudged flourish of any sort?
The BBC recently, for example.
No, I think sometimes when you're doing a live broadcast and you're looking at the clock and the camera, and sometimes you can misjudge it a bit. You know, you finish saying everything and there's still a few seconds left. You know, there's those moments where immediately you say, and follow me on Twitter.
I once forgot my own name on radio. I said, here's the sport with me. No, I said, here's the sport. Pause. Couldn't remember my own name and said, with me. That went down well. I don't believe in burning your bridges. I only ever did it once. I was a long time ago, central London, one of my first night jobs in a bar serving. I lasted about an hour and a half because a woman threw a fiver at me, crumpled it up with a £5 note and said, don't you want your tip, young man? And I'm afraid I screwed it back up and threw it in her face and said no, and she got me fired.
I stormed briefly out of a record shop that I was working in once and then remembered that I actually quite enjoyed the job, so I just sort of stormed back in and hoped nobody would hope nobody had really paid any attention to my storming out. Mercifully, they hadn't, which on the one hand was good news because it meant I got my job back. On the other hand, it made me realise how much attention anybody paid to me where I worked.
There are some fantastic examples of where people have you know, they've said, hey, everyone, see that guy there, our boss? And they've gone, damn, you know, slam, 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 and just called them out. And I think that is admirable and fantastic. It's just I've honestly never been in that position. I don't believe in burning bridges, but if it came to it, I'd burn it.
Well, on that happy note, and I feel like we should have actually tried to finish 10 seconds early and leave 10 seconds of awkward air in homage to Linda's
a lifetime.
Earlier observation, it can seem like a long time, but we've hit it pretty much exactly. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Tim Marshall and Linda Yu, thanks both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Millip. Thanks for listening.